to attract a new customer and keep them happy. Overhead. The larger your rent or mortgage payment, the more money you need to make each month to pay your expenses. The same general principle applies to businesses. Overhead represents the minimum ongoing resources required for a business to continue operation. This includes all of the things you need to run your business every month, regardless of whether you sell anything: salaries, rent, utilities, equipment repairs, and so on. The lower your overhead, the less revenue the business requires to continue operation, and the more quickly you'll reach your point of financial sufficiency. If you don't spend much, you don't have to make much to cover your expenses. Overhead is critically important if you are building your company on a fixed amount of capital. Venture capitalists and other forms of investment can provide seed capital, a fixed amount of money you can use to start the business. The more money you raise in capital and the more slowly you spend it, the more time you have to make the business work. The faster you burn through your capital, the more money you need to raise and the more quickly you need to start bringing in revenue. If you burn through all of your startup capital and can't raise more, game over. That's why investors and savvy entrepreneurs watch what's called the business's burn rate very closely. The slower the burn, the more time you have to create a successful business. The lower the overhead, the more flexibility you'll have and the easier it will be to sustain your business operations indefinitely. Fixed and variable costs. There's an old business saying, you have to spend money to make money. There's some truth to that statement, but not all expenses are created equal. Fixed costs are incurred no matter how much value you create. Your overhead is a fixed cost. No matter what you do in any given month, you still have to pay your salaried employees and the lease on your office space. Variable costs are directly related to how much value you create. If you're in the business of creating cotton t-shirts, the more t-shirts you produce, the more cotton fabric you'll need. Raw materials, usage-based utilities, and hourly workers are all variable costs. Reductions in fixed costs accumulate. Reductions in variable costs are amplified by volume. If you save $50 per month on your phone bill, that savings accumulates to $600 per year. If you can save 50 cents on each t-shirt you produce, you'll save $500 on every 1,000 t-shirts you make. The better you understand your costs, the more likely you are to find ways of producing as much value as possible without spending everything you make. Incremental degradation. Believe it or not, many of the chocolate products found in candy aisles of grocery stores are no longer milk chocolate. They're chocolate-flavored candies. What gives? To make high-quality chocolate, you have to buy high-quality cocoa beans, which are ground up to make cocoa butter. Cocoa butter is then combined with sugar, water, and emulsifiers, which help the oils in the cocoa butter stick to the water-saturated sugar. The liquid chocolate is then heated, poured into molds, and cooled to produce solid chocolate. Over the years, mass-market chocolate manufacturers decided to use cheaper ingredients to keep costs down and increase profitability. Instead of buying high-quality cocoa beans, they bought less expensive beans from mediocre sources. Who would notice? Then they replaced cocoa butter with vegetable oils, so much that food regulatory bodies wouldn't allow them to call it milk chocolate anymore. They added more emulsifiers, preservatives, and other chemicals to keep the zombified chocolate together and to make it last forever on the shelf. Sounds appetizing, right? Saving money doesn't help you if you degrade the quality of your offer. At the time, these cost-saving measures didn't appear to have a huge impact on the chocolate's quality. They seem to be a trade-off worth making. Over time, however, the accumulated effects undermined the taste and quality of the product. People noticed, and so did the manufacturers. You can now buy premium versions that contain the original high-quality ingredients. Finance and accounting executives get their bean-counting reputations from focusing primarily on cutting costs, reducing expenses in an effort to make an offer or business more profitable. Cutting costs can help you increase your profit margin, but it often comes at a steep price. If your goal is to increase your profitability, cutting costs can only take you so far. Creating and delivering value will always cost at least some amount of money, So there is a lower limit to how much you can cut costs before the cuts begin to diminish the value you provide. Cutting costs that are wasteful or unnecessary is certainly a good idea, but diminishing returns always kick in. Be careful not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Creating and delivering more value is a much better way to enhance your bottom line. You can never spend less than nothing, but there is no upper limit on the amount of value you can provide or revenue that you can collect. Control your costs, but don't undermine the reason customers buy from you in the first place. Break even. Assume your business is bringing in $100,000 per month and you're spending $50,000 each month in operating expenses. Are you making money? It depends. When you create a new business, it typically takes a while before you're able to bring in more than you spend. Systems need to be created, employees hired and trained, and marketing efforts launched before revenue starts coming in. During your ramp-up period, those expenses add up. Let's assume our hypothetical business took a year's worth of $50,000 per month expenses to launch. That's $600,000. Now that the business is bringing in $50,000 per month more than it needs to cover operating expenses, it can start to recover that initial investment. Break even is the point where your business's total revenue to date is equal to its total expenses to date. It's the point where your business starts creating wealth instead of consuming it. Assuming the business keeps bringing in $100,000 each month and expenses stay the same, it'll take 12 months to pay down the initial investment. After that, the business will be really making money. Before that, it just looks like the business is profitable. Your break-even point will change constantly. Revenue naturally fluctuates, as do expenses. Keeping a running tally of how much you spend and how much revenue you collect from the start of your business's operations is the only way to figure out whether or not you've actually made money. The more revenue you bring in and the less you spend on an ongoing basis, the more quickly you'll reach break-even, making your business truly self-sustaining. Amortization. You've created the toy of the century, a stuffed animal that looks and acts exactly like a real dog, but doesn't need to be fed, watered, or let out in the middle of the night. Kids go absolutely crazy for your prototype, and parents are already throwing their credit cards at you to make sure they get one the minute it's available. It's a foregone conclusion that you'll sell millions. There's only one problem. In order to make all of these fake dogs affordable, you'll have to tool up a major factory, which will cost at least $100 million. Your bank account has nowhere near $100 million in it. That's a heck of a lot of money. How can a business afford something as expensive as a factory and still make money? Amortization is the process of spreading the cost of a resource investment over the estimated useful life of that investment. In the case of the fake dog factory, let's assume that the factory is capable of producing 10 million units during its useful life. On a per-unit basis, that brings the cost per unit of the factory down to $10. If you sell every unit you produce for $100, that's a very healthy profit margin. Amortization can help you determine whether or not a big expense is a good idea. As long as you have a reliable estimate of how much it will cost and how much you can produce, amortization helps you figure out whether or not investing large amounts of capital makes sense. For example, a book designer may choose to purchase a copy of Adobe InDesign, the software commonly used by professionals to typeset books. Compared to most software packages, InDesign is pricey. A single-user license costs $700. Is it worth it? The answer depends on how many books the designer uses the software to typeset. If they never complete a project, they've wasted their money. If they use it to typeset 10 books for $1,000 each, they've earned $10,000 by making a $700 investment. Not bad at all. Amortized across 10 projects, the cost of the software is only $70 a project, or 7% of the revenue each project brings in. The designer's credit card may hurt when the purchase is made, but the tool offers the ability to earn more money than would be possible otherwise. Amortization depends on an accurate assessment of useful life, which is a prediction. Amortization doesn't work very well if you don't sell what you produce or if the equipment wears out more quickly than expected. Predictions are a tricky business. If you're wrong in your estimate, your investment may cost a lot more on a per-unit basis than you originally assumed. Crocs makes funny-looking rubber shoes. After becoming an unexpected hit, the company ramped up for huge volumes. They opened a factory in China and started producing millions of shoes in the expectation that they'd continue to sell each unit produced. As it turned out, Crocs were a fad. Sales plummeted, and the company was stuck with a lot of expensive manufacturing capacity and huge amounts of inventory it couldn't sell. Amortization couldn't save the company from careening toward bankruptcy. Using amortization to figure out whether or not a big investment is worth it is smart. Just remember you're making a prediction and proceed accordingly. Purchasing power. There's an old business saying you may have heard, cash is king. It's true. You can have millions of dollars in orders on the books, but without cash in the bank, it doesn't matter. IOUs don't pay the bills. If you can't pay your employees or keep the lights on, you're done. Purchasing power is the sum total of all liquid assets a business has at its disposal. That includes your cash, credit, and any outside financing that's available. More purchasing power is always better, as long as you use that power wisely. Purchasing power is what you use to pay your overhead and your suppliers. As long as you continue to pay them, you're in business. As soon as you run out of purchasing power, you're finished. Game over. Always keep track of how much purchasing power you have available. How much cash do you have in the bank? How much available credit do you have access to? The more purchasing power you have, the better off you are. Keeping track of your available purchasing power makes it much easier to run a business. Instead of constantly worrying about paying the bills, purchasing power gives you room to breathe, secure in the knowledge that you're not going to suddenly run out of money. That frees up a great deal of mental and emotional energy you can put to better use, figuring out how to improve your business. Always pay close attention to how much purchasing power you have left. It's the difference between a business that stays open and a business that fails. The cash flow cycle. Money flows through a business in predictable ways. If you understand how revenue, expenses, receivables, and credit work, you can ensure that you continue to have enough purchasing power on hand to continue operation and manage your available options. The cash flow cycle describes how cash flows through a business. Think of your business's bank account like a bathtub. If you want the water in the bathtub to rise, you add more water and keep it from leaking out via the drain. The more water that flows in and the less that flows out, the higher the level of water in the tub. Revenues and expenses work the same way. Receivables are promises of payment you've accepted from others. Receivables are attractive because they feel like a sale. Someone has promised to give you money, which is great. There's a catch, however. Receivables don't translate into cash until the promise is fulfilled. IOUs are not cash. The more quickly that promise is translated into payment, the better your cash flow. Many businesses have closed with millions of dollars of quote-unquote sales on the books. Debt is a promise you make to pay someone at a later date. Debt is attractive because you can benefit from a purchase now while holding on to your cash until later. The later you pay, the more cash you have at your disposal. Debt can be useful, but there's also a catch. Debts typically cost additional money in the form of interest. Very often, you'll have to pay back a portion of your debt over time, which is called debt service, which you can treat as another type of expense. If you can't cover your debt service, you're in trouble. Maximizing your cash tackles the issue directly. Bring in more revenue and cut costs. Increasing your product margins, making more sales, and spending less of what you bring in will always improve your cash flow. Deferring or negotiating a longer repayment period with your creditors can also help alleviate a cash crunch. If you have a supplier, vendor, or partner who is willing to let you pay later in exchange for receiving materials or capabilities now, that allows you to keep more cash in your bank account now. You must watch this carefully. Debts can easily get out of hand if you don't keep track of how much you owe and when it's due. When done properly, however, paying creditors later can be quite useful, particularly for marketing expenses. Borrowing $1 to make $10 is a good trade. It's even better if you're able to do that for months before the first bill comes due. To bring cash in more quickly, it's best to speed up collections and reduce the extension of credit. The faster you get paid, the better your cash flow situation. Ideally, try to get paid immediately, before buying raw materials and delivering value. It's common in many industries to extend credit to customers, but that doesn't mean you have to as well. Always remember that you are a business, not a bank, unless your business involves loans. Collect any outstanding payments as quickly as possible. If necessary, you can increase your purchasing power by taking on additional debt or opening lines of credit. It's best to avoid using debt or lines of credit if you don't absolutely need to, but increasing available credit certainly increases your purchasing power. Think of these accounts as backup funding sources for emergency use only. The more purchasing power you have, the more resilient your business is, and the better your ability to handle the unexpected. Opportunity cost. Let's say you decide to quit your $50,000 a year job and start a business. Starting the business will certainly have costs of its own, but it will also cost you the $50,000 you would have made had you stayed at your job. Opportunity cost is the value you're giving up by making a decision. We can't do everything at once. We can't be in more than one place at a time or spend the same dollar on two different things simultaneously. Whenever you invest time, energy, or resources, you're implicitly choosing not to invest that time, energy, or resources in any other way. The value that would have been created by your next best alternative is the opportunity cost of that decision. Opportunity cost is important because there are always other options. If you're working for a company that's paying you $30,000 a year, and you have the option to move to a company that's paying $200,000 a year for the same work, why would you stay? If you're paying your employees or contractors less than they could make elsewhere for the same work, why would they work for you? If your customers can spend $20 to get something you're charging $200 for, why would they buy from you? Opportunity cost is important because it's hidden. As we'll discuss later in absence blindness, humans have a hard time paying attention to what's not present. Paying attention to what you're giving up by making a decision helps you consider all of your options accurately before making the decision. Obsessing over opportunity costs too much can make you needlessly crazy, however. If you're a natural maximizer, like I am, it's tempting to overanalyze every decision to make sure you've chosen the very best option available, which can easily go well past the point of diminishing returns. Don't get bogged down with all of the options available. Consider only what appear to be the best alternatives at the time of your decision. If you pay attention to the opportunity cost of your decisions, you'll make much better use of the resources at your disposal. The time value of money. Would you rather have $1 million today or $1 million 5 years from now? The answer is obvious. Why wait? Having the money now means you can spend it now or invest it now. $1 million invested at a compounding interest rate of 5% will be $1,276,281.56 5 years from now. Why give up the extra quarter of $1 million if you don't need to? A dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow. How much more depends on what you choose to do with that dollar. The more profitable options you have to invest that dollar, the more valuable it is. Calculating the time value of money is a way of making decisions in the face of opportunity costs. Assuming you have various options of investing funds with various returns, the time value of money can help you determine which options to choose and how much you should spend, given the alternatives. Let's go back to the $1 million example. Assume someone offers you an investment that will deliver $1 million risk-free in 1 year's time. What's the maximum amount you should be willing to pay for it today? Assuming your next best alternative is another risk-free investment with a 5% interest rate, you shouldn't pay anything more than $952,380. Why? Because if you took that amount and invested it in your next best alternative, you'd have $1 million. $1 million divided by 1.25, the 5% interest discount rate, equals $952,380. If you can buy the first investment for less than that amount, you'll be ahead. The time value of money is a very old idea. It was first explained in the early 16th century by the Spanish theologian Martín de Azpilcueta. The central insight that a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow can be extended to apply to many common financial situations. For example, the time value of money can help you figure out the maximum you should be willing to pay for a business that earns $200,000 in profit each year. Assuming an interest rate of 5%, no growth, and a foreseeable future of 10 years, the present value of that series of future cash flows is $1,544,347. If you pay less than that amount, you'll come out ahead as long as your assumptions are correct. The time value of money is an extremely versatile concept, and a full exploration is beyond the scope of this book. For a more in-depth examination, I recommend picking up the McGraw-Hill 36-Hour Course in Finance for Non-Financial Managers by Robert A. Cook. Compounding. Here's a surefire way to become a millionaire. Save $10 a day for 40 years in a way that earns 8% interest. Saving $10 a day isn't difficult. You can save $300 a month by eliminating unnecessary expenses and earn 8% by investing that money simply and conservatively. I recommend the books Fail-Safe Investing by Harry Brown and I Will Teach You to Be Rich by Ramit Sethi if you're interested in tactical, low-risk investment strategies. Here's what's even more amazing. You'll only contribute $146,110 over that 40-year span. How, then, do you end up with over $1 million? Compounding is the accumulation of gains over time. Whenever you're able to reinvest gains, your investment will build upon itself exponentially, a positive feedback loop, which we'll discuss later. A simple example of compounding is a savings account. Let's say your bank account earns 5% interest. After a year, $1 in your bank account is going to be worth $1.05. In year two, you don't start with $1, you start with $1.05. In year three, you'll have $1.10. In year four, you'll have $1.15. 14 years after you make the initial deposit, you'll have $2. That doesn't sound like much until you consider that this relationship scales. If you start with $1 million, you'll have $2 million after 14 years. Not bad at all. Compounding is important because it creates the possibility of huge gains in a surprisingly short period of time. If you reinvest the revenue your business generates and your business is growing rapidly, you can multiply your original investment many times over. Compounding is the secret that explains how small companies that reinvest their profits become large companies in a few short years. Accumulating gains inevitably produces huge results over time. The trick is to be patient enough to wait for the reward. Leverage. Using other people's money sounds like a great way to make a fortune. Borrow some money, make a fortune, pay back your lender, and keep the rest. What could be better? Making money by borrowing from others can be savvy, provided you're aware of the risks. Leverage is the practice of using borrowed money to magnify potential gains. Here's an example. Let's assume you have $20,000 you'd like to invest in real estate. You could use that money as a 20% down payment on a $100,000 property, borrowing $80,000, but that ties up all of your money in a single investment. Instead of using the $20,000 for a single down payment, you could take the same pool of money and invest in four $100,000 properties, each with a down payment of $5,000. That strategy requires borrowing $95,000 four times, a total of $380,000 in loans. Here's where the magic happens. Let's assume all of the properties double in value and you sell them. In the first scenario, you'd make $100,000 on a $20,000 investment, a 5x return on your $20,000 down payment. In the second scenario, you'd make $400,000 on the very same $20,000 down payment, a 20x return on investment. Leverage seems like a no-brainer, right? Not so fast. What will happen if the value of each property drops dramatically and you sell them all to get back as much money as possible? Assuming the property value drops by 50%, in the first scenario, you'd lose $50,000. In the second scenario, the use of leverage will magnify your losses to $200,000, four times as much. Leverage is a form of financial amplification. It magnifies the potential for both gains and losses. When your investment pays off, leverage helps it pay off more. When your investment tanks, you lose more money than you would otherwise. One of the major contributing factors of the recession of 2008 through 2009 was the use of enormous amounts of leverage by investment banks. It wasn't uncommon for banks to leverage their investments by a factor of 30 or 40. Millions or billions of dollars were made or lost when the value of a particular stock went up or down by a single percentage point. When the market crashed, a bank's losses were magnified by the amount of leverage they had taken on, which was more than enough to threaten the entire firm's existence. Using leverage is playing with fire. It can be a useful tool if used appropriately, but it can also burn you severely. Never use leverage unless you're fully aware of the consequences and are prepared to accept them. Otherwise, you're putting your business and personal financial situation at risk. The hierarchy of funding. Imagine you've invented an anti-gravity device that can levitate solid objects without requiring much power. Your invention will revolutionize the transportation and manufacturing industries, making many new products possible. Demand for your invention is a given. All you need to do is create enough devices to fill the demand. There's a problem, however. Estimates indicate that tooling up a production line with the equipment you need to build these devices will cost $1 billion. Unfortunately, you don't have $1 billion to spare. Your device obviously solves a huge problem, but the next step is out of reach. What do you do? Funding can help you do things that would otherwise be impossible with your current budget. If your business requires expensive equipment or many workers to create and deliver value, you'll probably need outside funding. Few of us have enormous sums of money in our bank accounts waiting to be used, but it's surprisingly easy to reach out to those who do. Funding is the business equivalent of rocket fuel. If your business needs additional capacity and is already pointed in the right direction, wise use of financing can help you accelerate the operation's growth. If the business has structural issues, it will explode, and not in a good way. In order to obtain access to funding, it's often necessary to give up a certain amount of control over the business's operations. Business people won't give you money for nothing. They always ask something in return. Remember, providing capital is a form of value for many businesses. In exchange for resources, your lenders or investors are looking for value in return: interest, lease payments, or a share of your company's profits. They're also looking for a way to decrease their risk of losing everything if the business goes under. To alleviate this risk, they ask for control, the ability to influence the operations of the business. The more money you ask for, the more control they'll want. I think it's useful to imagine a hierarchy of funding, a ladder of available options. Every business person starts on the bottom and climbs as far up the ladder as necessary. The higher you climb, the more funding you get, and the more control you give up in exchange. Let's examine the hierarchy of funding, starting at the bottom. Personal cash is by far the best form of financing. Investing cash you already own is quick, easy, and requires no approval or paperwork. Most entrepreneurs begin by financing themselves out of cash as much as possible. Personal credit is another low-cost method of financing. As long as your needs don't exceed a few thousand dollars, it's easy to finance expenses via personal credit. Approval is generally quick if you have good credit, and payment over time helps increase your cash flow. You risk ruining your personal credit rating, a form of reputation, if you can't make your payments, but for many entrepreneurs, that's a risk worth taking. I financed my entire business out of cash and personal credit. If your needs are modest, using personal credit to finance your startup costs is a good option as long as you watch your budget. Personal loans are typically made by friends and family. If you need more money than you can cover via personal cash and personal credit, loans from friends and family are not uncommon. Just be wary. The risk that you won't be able to pay them back is very real and can have a devastating effect on important personal relationships. For that reason, I'd advise avoiding asking your parents or grandparents to gamble their life savings on your idea. There are better ways. Unsecured loans are typically made by banks and credit unions. You fill out an application, ask for a certain amount of money, and the bank will evaluate your ability to pay the loan back with interest over a certain time period. The loan can either be a lump sum or a line of credit that can be used at any time. The bank doesn't ask for collateral for smaller amounts, so the interest rate will probably be a bit higher than a credit card or a secured loan. Secured loans require collateral. Mortgages and automotive loans are good examples of secured loans. If you don't make the payments, the lender can legally seize the property promised as collateral. Because the lender can then sell that property to recover their funds, secured loans are much larger than unsecured loans, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. Bonds are debt sold to individual lenders. Instead of asking a bank for a loan directly, the business asks individuals or other companies to loan them money directly. Bond purchasers give money directly to the business, which is paid back at an agreed-upon rate for a certain period of time. When the time expires, the company must give back the original loan amount in addition to the payments already made. The legal and regulatory process that surrounds the bond market can be extremely complicated, so bond issues are typically conducted through an investment bank. Receivables financing is a special type of secured lending unique to businesses. Receivables financing can make millions of dollars in credit available, but at a cost. The collateral for the loan is control over the business's receivables. Since the bank controls the receivables, they can ensure their loan is paid before anything else, including employee salaries and vendor commitments. Large amounts of funding are available, but you're giving up a great deal of control to the lender. Angel capital is where we shift from loans to capital. An angel is an individual private investor, someone who has excess wealth they'd like to invest in a private business, typically in the $10,000 to $1 million range. In exchange, they'll own 1 to 10% of the business. Taking on an angel investor is a bit like taking on a silent partner. They give you capital, and in exchange, you give them partial legal ownership of the business. Some angels offer advice and are available for consulting, but they generally don't have the power to make business decisions. Venture capital takes over where angels leave off. Venture capitalists, also called VCs, are extremely wealthy investors or groups of investors who pool their funds with very large sums of capital available, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in a single investment. Funding via venture capital happens in rounds that start small, then grow as more capital is needed. Later rounds can dilute the ownership percentage of current shareholders, so there's typically a great deal of negotiation involved. VCs also require large amounts of control in exchange for large amounts of capital, which usually means seats on the company's board of directors. A public stock offering involves selling partial ownership of the company to investors on the open market. This is typically done via investment banks, companies that will provide a business with enormous amounts of capital in exchange for the shares of that company to sell in the public stock market. The investment banks make money by selling the shares they've purchased at a premium to individual investors on the open market. An initial public offering, also called an IPO, is simply the first public stock offering a company offers on the open market. Any investor who purchases shares is legally a partial owner of the company, which includes the right to participate in management decisions via electing the board of directors. Whoever owns the most shares in the company controls it, so going public creates the risk of a hostile takeover, the mass purchasing of shares in an effort to control the company. Public stock offerings are typically used by angel and venture capital investors to exchange ownership for money. Investors can collect their returns in one of two ways, reaping dividends that distribute the profits of the company, or selling their shares to another investor. Public stock offerings enable investors to sell their shares in exchange for money, so it's common for angels and VCs to push successful companies to go public or be acquired by another company as quickly as possible in order to cash out of the investment. The more control you must give up for each dollar of funding obtained, the less attractive the source of funding. The more people you're required to consult with before making decisions, the slower your company will operate. Investors can increase communication overhead, which can adversely affect your ability to get things done quickly. It's also not uncommon for investors to remove executives of a company that's not performing well, even if those executives are the founders of the company. even high-flying executives aren't immune. When Apple was performing poorly in the 1990s, the board of directors fired Steve Jobs from the company he co-founded. A word to the wise. Before you take on large amounts of capital, be aware of how much power the business's board of directors will have over the operation of the company. Funding can be useful, but be wary of giving up control over your business's operations. Don't do it lightly or blindly. Bootstrapping. How much financing you need depends largely on what you're trying to do. If you're grasping for the brass ring, becoming obscenely wealthy by building a massive public company, you'll probably need financing. If your intent is to be self-sufficient and free to make your own decisions, it's much better to avoid financing in favor of retaining control. Bootstrapping is the art of building and operating a business without funding. Don't assume that the only way to create a successful business is by raising millions of dollars of venture capital. It's simply not true. By limiting yourself to the use of personal cash, personal credit, the business's revenue, and a little ingenuity, you can build extremely successful businesses without seeking funding at all. My business operates via a checking account, a savings account, and a business credit card, and I like it that way. Bootstrapping allows you to grow your business while maintaining 100% control over the business's operations. You don't have to get anyone else's approval to make the decisions you think are best. The drawback is that growing the business can take much longer. Prudently used, funding can help you make things happen much more quickly than they'd happen otherwise. If you accept funding, make sure that you use it to do things that you couldn't do any other way. Force multipliers are useful, but expensive. Taking on funding in order to get access to critical capabilities can be very smart. Otherwise, try to operate from cash and operating revenue as much as possible. For best results, bootstrap as far as you can go, then move up the hierarchy of funding only as needed. Having 100% ownership and control of a profitable, self-sustaining business is a beautiful thing. Return on investment. When you invest in something, you expect it to provide more value than you paid for it. Knowing how to estimate how much you'll receive versus how much you'd invest is a very useful skill. Return on investment is the value created from an investment of time or resources. Most people think of ROI in terms of currency. If you invest $1,000 and you collect $100 in profit, that's a 10% return on your investment. If your return on investment is 100%, you've doubled your initial investment. Return on investment can help you decide between competing alternatives. If you deposit money in a savings account, the return on your investment will be equal to the interest rate that the bank gives you to hold onto your money. Why put your money in an account that pays 1% interest if you can deposit that money in an account that pays 2% with no difference in fees? The usefulness of return on investment extends far beyond money. You can use it for other currencies as well. Return on invested time is an extremely useful way to analyze the benefits of your effort. If you were forced to work 24 hours a day, nonstop for a year, in exchange for $1 million, would you do it? When you look at the return versus the cost to your time and sanity, it's not worth it. The return on every investment is always directly related to how much the investment costs. The more you spend, in terms of both money and time, the lower your return. Even quote-unquote sure bets, like buying a house or getting a college degree, aren't wise if you pay too much for them. Every investment of return is speculative. You never know how it will actually turn out. Calculating returns is an exercise in predicting the future, which is fundamentally impossible. Every future ROI estimate is a semi-educated guess. You can only know your ROI for certain after the investment is made and the returns collected. Nothing in this world is a sure bet. Always take into account the risk of something going wrong before making an investment, no matter how high the potential ROI appears to be. Sunk cost. After returning from World War II, my grandfather started the Kaufman Construction Company, building storefronts, homes, union halls, and apartment buildings in Akron, Ohio. In 1965, after 25 years in the business, he kicked off his most ambitious project, a 5-story, 26-unit apartment building on Portage Path. The Baronelle was to be built on the lots of two older homes, which had been purchased and demolished for the job. Steel rebar and bricks were ordered, and excavation was proceeding as planned. The expected cost of the project was $300,000, roughly $2.4 million in 2010 dollars. The project proceeded smoothly until the excavators found huge hidden deposits of blue clay, which could make the foundation extremely unstable. To continue the project, thousands of cubic feet of clay and dirt would have to be excavated to reach bedrock, and additional concrete and rebar would be required to fill the massive hole. Completing the building would cost far more than originally expected, but it was difficult to determine exactly how much. Instead of walking away, Grandpa decided to finish the project. He'd already spent so much money on the land and excavation that it felt wrong to waste it without having something to show for the effort and investment. He found a few investors, put up another apartment building and family home as collateral, and the project continued. By the time the building was complete, they'd spent over three times as much money as originally planned, approximately $1 million, roughly $8 million in today's dollars when adjusted for inflation. It was more than the building was worth. Grandpa spent the rest of his career handling angry investors and lawyers. It's a sad story, but one worth learning from. Sunk costs are investments of time, energy, and money that can't be recovered once they've been made. No matter what you do, you can't get those resources back. Continuing to invest in a project to recover lost resources doesn't make sense. All that matters is how much more investment is required versus the reward you expect to obtain. Sunk cost is easy to understand conceptually, but much harder to put into practice. When you sink years of work into a career you realize you don't want, or millions of dollars into a project that unexpectedly requires millions more, it's difficult to walk away. You've invested so much that it feels wrong to give it up for nothing. In reality, there's nothing you can do about your past investment. It's gone. All you can do is act based upon the information you have right now. Making mistakes is inevitable. No one is perfect. You will make a few decisions that, in retrospect, you'll wish you hadn't. Count on it. If you could turn back time, you'd do things differently. Unfortunately, you can't. There will always be other projects, provided you don't double down on a risky project to recover your losses. Throwing good money after bad is not a winning strategy. Don't continue to pour concrete into a bottomless pit. If it's not worth the additional investment, walk away. You never have to earn back money in the same way you lost it. If the reward isn't worth the investment required to obtain it, or the risk, don't invest. Internal controls. One of the major benefits of tracking your financial and operations data over time is the ability to notice patterns in your revenue, costs, and value chain. Over time, these patterns become useful for budgeting, supervising operations, complying with laws and regulations, and preventing theft and fraud. Internal controls are a set of specific standard operating procedures a business uses to collect accurate data, keep the business running smoothly, and spot trouble as quickly as possible. The better a company's internal controls, the more reliable its financial reports, and the more confidence you can have in the quality of the company's operations. Internal controls are most useful in four areas. Budgeting is the act of estimating future costs and taking steps to ensure that these estimates aren't exceeded without good reason. Budgets are very important in controlling profit margins, the cash flow cycle, and leverage. If part of your business breaks the budget in a given time period, you can take action to correct the situation. Supervision is important in businesses that rely on employees or outside firms for important parts of its business process. By establishing controls related to delivery time, quality, cost, and systems failures, it's possible to conduct evaluations and make changes in operations if necessary, if standards appear to slip or performance targets aren't met. Compliance is necessary when a business operates in an industry affected by government regulations. The company may be obligated to collect and report certain data in the course of operations. Internal controls ensure that this data is complete and accurate, preventing risks, significant losses, and potential legal issues. Theft and fraud prevention is important to protect against the risk of financial loss by an unscrupulous party. Solid internal controls make it easier to notice something is amiss, identify the responsible party, and resolve the situation with a minimum of fuss. In all of these areas, it's useful to have a dispassionate third party audit your data and control processes. Auditing is necessary to find and correct errors, particularly in large businesses with many moving parts. Auditing helps ensure the quality of the company's data and can increase the confidence of lenders, investors, shareholders, and regulatory bodies regarding the business's practices. In all cases, the auditing party should have no interest in the outcome. This separation of concerns helps ensure the results are accurate, particularly if they're not pretty. Financial controls also help you benchmark your company against other companies in your market. Every year, the Risk Management Association, abbreviated RMA, compiles a huge amount of data from businesses in all industries. The RMA dataset makes it easier to discover what solvent businesses of various sizes spend on marketing, sales, operation, and capital in a given period of time. Banks and investors rely on RMA data to determine whether or not a business they're examining is typical. If the company's costs are in line with revenues, outside parties are more likely to assume the business has a lower risk profile. If the company is spending 3 times the typical amount on sales and marketing, it can be a signal of trouble, inefficiency, or shady accounting. Industry groups can also be a useful source of data. Many markets have trade associations that collect and share information about successful businesses. By comparing your business's data to that of other companies in your market, you can get a better picture of how well you're performing and where your business could use improvement. Chapter 6. The Human Mind. Now that we've covered the essentials of how businesses work, we're going to shift gears into understanding how people work. Businesses are built by people, for people. As we discussed in value creation and value delivery, if people didn't have needs and wants, businesses wouldn't exist. Likewise, if no one was able or willing to fulfill those needs and wants, businesses couldn't operate. Understanding how we take in information, how we make decisions, and how we decide what to do or what not to do is critically important if you want to create and sustain a successful business venture. Once you have a clear picture of how the human mind works, it's easy to find better ways to get things done and work more effectively with others. Caveman Syndrome. Imagine for a moment what it would be like to have lived 100,000 years ago. Your senses are on full alert as you walk along the banks of a river, scanning for food, fish swimming in the stream, edible plants, or animals to catch. The sun is nearing its apex, and you've already walked 6 miles today. Your calloused feet will take you 6 miles more before the day is done. In a few hours, you'll stop for some water and find shade. The mid-afternoon sun is blazingly hot, and rest will help you conserve energy. As you walk, your eyes settle on a small bush about 20 feet away. Your heart leaps, you recognize the pattern of the leaves, and you know that both the leaves and the roots are good to eat. You start to dig at the earth around the base of the plant to expose the roots, intending to place the entire shrub into the simple woven basket you have strapped to your back. Suddenly, you notice a movement out of the corner of your eye. 4 feet away, a massive cobra has drawn itself up to strike, displaying its distinctive patterned hood and sharp fangs. There's no time to think. Adrenaline surges, your pulse races, and you quickly jump up and run away as fast as you're able, leaving the food behind. You run until it's clear the threat is gone, and then you spend a few minutes recovering, trembling from the exertion and the stress as the adrenaline wears off. You're disappointed about losing the food, but it wasn't worth risking your life. Once you recover, you again search for food and shelter from the midday sun. Tonight, you'll return to your tribe to share what food you found. You know everyone well, since there are only 40 or so people in the tight-knit group. You've banded together primarily for protection from wild animals and other tribes, who periodically attempt to seize your tribe's resources via raids. Together, you make spears and nets to catch fish, turn flint into knives and axes for hunting and defense, and create baskets and clay pots to store food. On the fire, an antelope is roasting. A group of hunters in your tribe literally chased it to death, a technique called persistence hunting. In the evening, you'll sit around the fire the group has built to cook food and keep predators away, and you'll discuss the day and tell stories until you drift off to sleep. Tomorrow, you'll do it all over again. Human biology is optimized for conditions that existed 100,000 years ago, not for the world in which we actually live today. Food is everywhere. predators are not. You no longer have to be in constant motion. Instead, you probably spend most of your time occupied by sedentary activities, like sitting behind a desk at a computer. As a result, we face many new threats to our brains and bodies, like obesity, heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, and chronically low energy. Your brain and body simply aren't optimized for the modern world. Part of the challenge of working in the modern world is that our brains and bodies are tuned for physical and social survival, not 16-hour workdays. Business hasn't been around long enough for our biology to adapt to the new demands we're placing on ourselves. Don't be too hard on yourself. You simply weren't built for the type of work you're currently responsible for. No one is. We're all running demanding new software on ancient hardware. Performance requirements. Pounding Red Bull and pulling all-nighters can only take you so far. If you want to do good work, taking care of yourself isn't optional. If you don't give your body what it needs to run, you'll run out of gas long before you reach your goals. Your mind is first and foremost a physical system. Oftentimes, what we experience as mental fatigue or emotional distress is simply a signal from our body that we're not getting enough of something we physically need: nutrients, exercise, or rest. If you want to get things done, you can't run on empty. The human body has performance requirements. Just as a car can't run with an empty gas tank or a broken spark plug, your body can't operate for long without a few necessary inputs. When you have a lot of work to do, it's common to think that taking care of yourself is a secondary concern. It's not. Taking care of yourself should be your primary concern if you want to get important things done without burning out. Nutrition, exercise, and rest are the inputs your body converts into productive energy. Poor or too little input inevitably reduces the quantity and quality of your output. Here are a few basic guidelines to help you get the most out of each day. Eat high-quality food. Garbage in, garbage out. Pay attention to what you put into your body. If you eat meat, eggs, or dairy, avoid sources that contain antibiotics or hormones. Also, avoid refined sugar and processed foods as much as possible. If your great-grandparents wouldn't immediately recognize it as food, don't eat it. Eating a small snack or meal every 2.5 hours or so helps keep your blood sugar stable, so you don't crash during the day. I'm the kind of guy who sometimes forgets to eat, so I try to keep things simple. A handful of almonds or a piece of fruit works best for me. Use caffeine in moderation. Herbal tea is a good substitute for soda, and carrying a water bottle makes it much easier to stay hydrated. Exercise regularly. According to the book Brain Rules by John Medina, even low-intensity physical activity increases energy, improves mental performance, and enhances your ability to focus. Going for a walk or run, jumping rope, or doing a bit of yoga can help clear the cobwebs in your mind and give you more energy for the rest of the day. I often swing around a 14-pound sledgehammer to get my blood pumping. It's a cheap and effective weightlifting tool that doesn't take up much space. Just don't hit anything. Get at least 7 to 8 hours of sleep each night. Sleep helps consolidate the results of pattern matching and mental simulation, as well as reverse the effects of willpower depletion, all ideas we'll discuss later. So don't skimp on rest. I find it useful to set an alarm to remind me to go to bed, giving me enough time to wind down before retiring for the night. Going to bed early helps you get up early, which is very useful if you do creative work. I find it's best to write or do other creative tasks before the day begins, so you don't get distracted and run out of time. Get enough sun, but not too much. Vitamin D is an important part of many chemical reactions in your body, and your body can only create it if your skin is exposed to direct, non-filtered sunlight. Light through windows doesn't count. Just don't get too much. Sunburns and skin cancer aren't fun. Light helps set your circadian rhythm, which affects your sleeping patterns. I regularly use a light therapy device to ensure that I'm getting enough light, particularly in the winter months. Getting as little as 10 minutes of sunlight in the morning is a very easy way to improve both your sleep and your mood. Feed your brain the raw materials it needs to run. If you've ever felt angry, sad, apathetic, or lethargic for no reason, your body may not be getting enough of the raw materials necessary to build the neurotransmitters responsible for making you feel good. In the book The Mood Cure, Julia Ross explains that your brain needs certain compounds to produce critical mood-altering neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin. Without the materials necessary to build these mood-altering chemicals, you'll feel off, even if everything in your world is going just fine. Modern dietary changes make it necessary to get some of these substances in supplement form. A good multivitamin supplement, fish oil, magnesium, and essential amino acids can go a long way to ensure your brain has what it needs to function effectively. Just make sure that whatever you buy is highly bioavailable. Supplements won't help you if they pass through your body undigested. I constantly experiment with new ways to improve my energy, productivity, and mood, and I recommend you do the same. Guiding structure can help make these lifestyle changes much easier. Changing the structure of my environment has helped me make many changes almost effortlessly, including 3 years on a vegan diet, which is no animal products. Don't be afraid to try something new to see if you notice an improvement. Just be safe. When in doubt, consider how your ancient ancestors lived and act accordingly. The onion brain. Most of us identify with the voice inside our head that's constantly commenting about the world around us. That voice is sometimes electric with excitement, but more often it's uncertain, concerned, or scared. Fortunately, you are not that voice. You are only a small part of your brain. The voice in your head is just a radio announcer, commenting on what your brain is doing automatically. It is not you. Your consciousness is actually what your brain uses to solve problems it can't handle on autopilot. Since human behavior has its roots in the brain, it's very useful to understand how your brain is actually constructed. Here's a brief and massively oversimplified look at how your brain works. Think of the brain as an onion. It has several layers which sit on top of each other. At the core is a structure called the hindbrain, which is essentially responsible for keeping you alive. The hindbrain is responsible for all of the physiological functions necessary for survival: heart rate, sleeping, waking, reflexes, muscle movements, and biological urges. Located at the base of the brain, the hindbrain is sometimes called the lizard brain because this basic neurological structure appears in all of our biological precursors, including reptiles and amphibians. The hindbrain is primarily responsible for generating signals that are passed down through your spinal cord and nerves to every part of your body, resulting in your physical actions. Above your hindbrain is the midbrain, which is responsible for processing sensory data, emotion, memory, and pattern matching, which we'll discuss later. Our midbrains are constantly and automatically predicting what will happen next, then sending that information to the hindbrain, which readies our body for immediate action. The midbrain is the radio announcer, and the hindbrain is the radio. Sitting just above the midbrain is a thin, folded layer of tissue, the forebrain. This small sheet of brain matter is responsible for the cognitive capabilities that make us distinctly human: self-awareness, logic, deliberation, inhibition, and decision. Developmentally speaking, the forebrain is very new and likely evolved to help us handle ambiguity. Most of the time, our midbrain and hindbrain run the show. We're operating on instinct and autopilot. That changes, however, when we face something unexpected or unfamiliar, which confounds the midbrain's ability to predict what will happen next. That's when the forebrain kicks into gear, gathering data and considering options. After some deliberation and analysis, the forebrain decides what to do based on what appears to be best at the time. Once a decision is made, the midbrain and hindbrain assume normal operation and carry out the decision. Neuroscientists are probably ready to shoot me at this point, but this very basic model of the brain is accurate enough to be useful. PJ Eby, my mind-hacking friend and mentor, uses a great analogy to explain the relationship between the different parts of your mind. Your brain is a horse, and you are the rider. Your horse is intelligent. It moves on its own, can identify challenges, and will balk at things that appear dangerous or scary. You, the rider, are there to set a direction and reassure the horse that it's safe to proceed. One of the best things you can do to get more done is to dissociate yourself from the voice in your head. The radio announcer has the attention span of a 2-year-old after drinking a triple espresso. Its job is to highlight things in your environment you may be interested in paying attention to, things that may fulfill one of the core human drives or present some danger. That doesn't mean the voice is always right, or that you must take everything it says as gospel truth. Meditation is a simple practice that can help you separate you from the voice in your head. There's nothing mystical or magical about meditation. You simply breathe and watch what your monkey mind does without associating yourself with it. After a while, the voice becomes quieter, improving your ability to keep yourself on the course you choose. A few moments of quiet meditation every day can be the difference between feeling scared and overwhelmed and feeling in control of your destiny. If you're interested in learning to meditate, I recommend the book Wherever You Go, There You Are by Jon Kabat-Zinn. Perceptual control. In businesses and business schools around the world, B.F. Skinner is the hidden king. Skinner was one of the major intellectual forces behind the behaviorist movement in psychology, the idea that biological systems always respond a certain way to certain stimuli. Control the stimuli, and you can control the behavior. Condition the organism with rewards and punishments, and the organism will learn exactly how to behave. Over the decades, behaviorism has fallen out of vogue in psychology. Research has made it clear that there's far more to behavior than the carrot and the stick. Unfortunately, that hasn't extended to business practice. In corporations and business school classrooms around the world, the search continues for the magic incentive that will make people do exactly what businesses want. In reality, human behavior is much more like a thermostat. A thermostat is a very simple system. All it consists of is a sensor, a set point, and a switch. The sensor measures the temperature of the surrounding environment. When the temperature is within a given range, the thermostat does nothing. When the temperature is below the set point, the switch turns the heater on. Once the temperature is above the set point, the switch turns the heater off. This relationship is called perceptual control. The thermostat controls the temperature of the room by comparing the perceived temperature against the set point, then taking an action if and only if that perception is out of control. Once the action brings the perception under control, the system stops acting until the set point is violated once again. Living organisms, including human beings, are essentially very complex perceptual control systems. We act in ways to keep our perceptions of the world within acceptable boundaries. We don't put on a coat because the cold weather forces us to. We put on a coat because we feel cold and we don't want to feel cold. If the light entering our eyes is too bright, we find shade, pull down the blinds on the windows, or put on sunglasses. The action controls the perception, and the action we ultimately take depends on the environment we find ourselves in at the time. In the book Making Sense of Behavior, The Meaning of Control, William T. Powers uses the following example to explain how control systems account for the wide range of behaviors human beings exhibit. Imagine a ship in the middle of an ocean during a wild storm. The ship is rising and falling randomly, pitching back and forth as it's buffeted by the waves. A rock on the deck of the ship is not a control system. The rock doesn't want anything, so it has nothing to control. It just tumbles wherever the forces of physics take it. A human being on the ship, however, wants to stay upright, and will therefore take many different actions to continue to stay standing, changing balance, moving, holding onto handrails, etc. If the human stumbles and falls, they'll take whatever actions they can to get back on their feet once more. The environment dictates which actions are possible to bring the perception under control. Control is not planning. It's adjusting to changes in the environment as they actually happen. The human in the storm doesn't have the ability to predetermine what actions they'll take to stay on their feet. As the environment changes, their actions will change in response, depending on the resources and options available at the moment. Perceptual control explains why the same stimulus often produces different responses. A good example of why the stimulus-response model doesn't paint the whole picture is the classic incentive of many employers, paid overtime. If you want your hourly employees to work more, you should pay them more overtime, right? Not necessarily. Workers who are controlling for income, that is, they don't have enough income and they want more, will probably work more overtime. But what about workers who feel they're making enough money or have priorities that are more important than work? A few of those workers will work exactly the same amount of time, and some will actually work less. They're controlling for a certain amount of income, then spending their time doing other things that are important to them, like being with their family or pursuing a side project. Raising overtime pay will allow them to reach that point more quickly, so they'll spend less time at work. The overtime incentive produces three different results, two of which are complete opposites, working more and working less. So much for behaviorism. Perceptual control represents a fundamental shift in understanding why people do the things they do. Once you understand that people act to control their perceptions, you'll be better equipped to influence how they act. Reference level. At the heart of every perceptual control system is a reference level, a range of perceptions that indicate the system is under control. When a perception is within the system's reference level, nothing happens. When the perception violates the reference level by being too high or too low, the system will act to bring the perception back under control. There are three kinds of reference levels: set points, ranges, and errors. A set point is a minimum or maximum value. The thermostat is an example of a set point. Whenever the temperature falls below a certain value, the heater kicks on. Your body's production of melatonin is another set point. Once it reaches a particular threshold, you'll start falling asleep. Business financial controls are managed as set points. As long as your revenue is above a certain set point and your expenses are below a certain set point, you're okay. If you suddenly spend three times what you normally spend, or your revenue falls below your point of sufficiency, that triggers action. You want to find out why you overspent and how to bring your expenses back under control. A range is a spread of acceptable values. The difference between a range and a set point is the existence of an upper and a lower limit to the perception being controlled. With a set point, the perception must be above or below a certain level to be under control. With a range, the perception must be between two set points to be under control. For example, your body has a system for regulating the level of glucose in your blood, which it uses for energy. Too much or too little blood glucose can be life-threatening, so your body works to keep the level within an acceptable range by releasing insulin, which causes extra glucose to move into or out of the cells in your body. As long as your blood glucose is within the acceptable range, nothing happens. When the reference range is violated, your body starts working to bring the situation back under control. An error is a set point defined as zero. Any perception that's not zero is out of control. Think of the pain receptors in your skin. Most of the time, they do nothing, which means everything is under control. If you cut or burn yourself, however, the receptors send a signal that something is wrong, and you'll act to remedy the situation. Customer service complaints are a business example. If you don't receive any, everything is under control. If your inbox is filling with complaints, you know that something needs to be fixed. If you want to change a behavior, you must either change the system's reference level or change the environment in which the system is operating. Think back to the thermostat. If you want to turn the heater off, you can change the set point to a lower temperature. If you're aware that your expenses will be three times what they were in the last month because you're launching a huge marketing campaign, your finances are no longer out of control. If you're in the process of getting a tattoo, pain receptors firing is an acceptable situation. The perceptions themselves haven't changed, but you'll no longer act to bring the perception under control because it already is under control. Changing the reference level changes the behavior of the system. Consciously defining and redefining reference levels can help you change your behavior. If you're worried that your spending is out of control, you can create a budget that will give you information on what your target monthly revenue needs to be in order to stay sufficient. If you're worried that your weight is too high or low, a visit to your doctor can help you calibrate your expectations and self-perception against medical data. If you're consistently working 12-hour days and you decide that no more than 8 is acceptable, your work habits will change. Change the reference level, and your behavior will change automatically. Conservation of energy. Here's a universal truth of human nature. People are generally lazy. The critical